This is the third lesson in a short series on the theme of the cross, the importance of the cross, the centrality of the cross. I believe the death of Christ is the central, supreme, most important topic, certainly in the Gospels and in the Bible. I believe that because of the continual allusions that Christ makes to the cross, the references the Gospels make to it. Christ instituted a rite that is meant to memorialize his death. And the cross is mentioned at least 175 times in the New Testament. Now, baptism is not mentioned that many times. The Lord's Supper is not mentioned that many times, but the cross is. And here's the kicker. There is no event that is more incomprehensible than the cross of Christ. In fact, the one who understood it perfectly came to a time when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And there are events in the life of Christ that prepare us for what's going to happen at the end of the gospel story. Because, especially in the Gospel of Matthew, not only are the events that Matthew arranges meant to point us toward the end of the story, to point us toward the cross, but those events that Matthew mentioned go far beneath the surface of being mere physical preludes to Christ's death. The things that Matthew talks about take us into that depth of doubt of which we're capable in our soul, where we ask, my God, what's going on here? I mean, we open the Gospel of Matthew learning that the entrance of Christ into the world involves the shame, the scandal of illegitimacy, fornication. We turn the page, we read about those innocents at Bethlehem who are slaughtered for no good reason. My God, why? We turn the page, we see Christ standing in a line that is meant for sinners to be baptized. Why did he have to do that? We turn the page. He's out in the wilderness where he's not eaten for 40 days. And we ask, my God, why? And I want to read you a quote from C.S. Lewis that I think, at least for me, explains as well as anything can the whyness of all those things. C.S. Lewis is talking about what the philosophers call the problem of pain. You know, there are things that are not understandable unless God is, and there are things that aren't understandable if He is. And the second of these that we call the problem of pain, the existence of evil, especially unmerited, innocent suffering, has always posed the greatest challenge to belief in God. And C.S. Lewis, in his Letters to Malcolm, is talking about these problems. Here's what he said. You see how characteristic, how representative it all is, the human situation writ large. These are among the things it means to be a man. Every rope breaks when we seize it. Every door is slammed shut when you reach it. As for the last dereliction of all, how can we either understand or endure it? Is it that God Himself cannot be man unless God seems to vanish at the point of our greatest need? I had this on an overhead and I walked off and left my computer on. Has there ever been a time in your life when God has just seemed to vanish when you need Him most? You're facing some problem, some challenge, you don't understand it. If you ever need God, it's times like that, and He is nowhere to be found so far as you can see. Now, that's part of the human predicament. And if Christ was going to be made in all points like as we are, that He might be a perfect and faithful high priest, there had to be times in the life of Christ when God seemed to vanish, when He was nowhere to be found, because that's our lot. What happened to Christ, what we read in the Gospels, is humanity written large. This is what it means to be a man, that there are times when God is not to be found, and what are we to do during those times? And so we open Matthew. Why did he have to bring his son into the world to involve his mother in the shame of the whisper of fornication? That's just not right. The slaughter of the innocents, that's just not right. The sinless ones standing in a line of sinners numbered with the transgressors to be baptized, that's just not right. Out there in the wilderness with nothing to eat, that's not right. But we come to something in the Gospels that we look at it and we say, that's right. I understand that. This is the way it ought to be. And that thing that I'm talking about is the transfiguration. And that's what I want to speak about tonight, because I believe the transfiguration, just like Christ's birth, his baptism, his temptation, the transfiguration is meant to point us ahead to the end of the story. The transfiguration is counted among the supernatural events in the life of Christ, but there is one big distinction to make. Every miracle Christ worked, every supernatural act he performed, was him doing it for someone else. Healing disease, making the maimed whole, raising the dead, stopping storms. He did things on behalf of others. But with the transfiguration, we have a supernatural event in which he was not the giver, but the receiver. This was something that was done to him. And it points toward the end. I mean, just about everything in the Gospel of Matthew, and probably the other three Gospels as well, point us toward the end, toward the cross. Let me give you one example. Turn to chapter 14 of Matthew, the feeding of the 5,000. Have you ever noticed the connection, the similarity between the language, the verbs used to describe Christ feeding the 5,000 and the verbs used in Matthew 26 to describe the Last Supper? In chapter 14 of Matthew, I think I want verse 19. Let me turn there. Notice these verbs. Then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass, and he took the five loaves and the two fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples. Now keep your finger there and turn to Matthew chapter 26 and look at verse 26. Matthew 26, 26. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed, and broke, and gave it to the disciples. Almost exactly the same layout, same words. The next day, after the feeding of the 5,000, Christ says, Now I'm the bread of life. My flesh, my blood, this is what you're to eat. He eats with the disciples in the Last Supper, breaks the bread, says, this is my body given for you. Attaches symbolism in both events. But then notice what happens after he feeds the 5,000. They want to make him a king. He tells the disciples, you guys get out of here. They had enough wrong ideas in their head already. They didn't need to have them stoked by the sentiment of the 5,000. He says, you guys get in the boat and you sail to the other side of the lake. And then Christ deals with the 5,000. And during the fourth watch of the night, between 3 and 6 a.m., Jesus sees the disciples in the boat in the middle of the lake, going nowhere, making no headway. And Christ goes walking to them on the lake. And skeptics look at that and say, that's a bunch of baloney. There's no truth to that. Men cannot walk on water. And they're right. The human body, the physical human body, cannot walk on water. The physical human body cannot go through rock. It cannot go through walls in a room that's locked and appear inside. Our physical body can't do that. But I wonder if a spiritual body can. I wonder if a spiritual body can walk on water, go through rock, go through walls. The feeding of the 5,000... and the significance of the bread there and all of that is followed by demonstrations of power far beyond the ability of mere man. And the cross is going to be followed by the greatest demonstration of power ever. I mean, just everywhere you look, folks, in the Gospels, it keeps pointing us ahead to the end of the story, to the cross. Now, with that said, turn to Mark chapter 6. Turn to Mark chapter 6. There's something worth noting. And what is worth noting is that Matthew, Mark, Luke, who tell the story of the transfiguration, each of them connect the transfiguration to something that had preceded it. And they use a time frame to connect it. Matthew and Mark say, after 6 days, something happened, and then after 6 days, Jesus was transfigured. Luke says, after about 8 days, something happened. After about 8 days, Jesus was transfigured. Now, there's no discrepancy between the 6 days and the 8 days. It just depends on how you're counting the days. I'm going to Israel in May, Lord willing. I'm going to be gone from May 10th to May 22nd. So I can say I'm going to be gone 12 days, but I'm only going to be in Israel, you know, a little over 10 days. So depending on how I'm reckoning how long I'm going to be in Israel, it could be 12 or 10. No big deal. And that's what we have with Christ and Matthew, Mark, and then Christ and Luke. So about a week after something happened, occurred the transfiguration. Now, what was it that happened a week prior to the transfiguration? Well, let me lead you up to it by asking you to look at Mark chapter 6, verse 30 and 31. The disciples, Luke tells us this, had returned from their test drive. Christ had sent them out preaching the gospel of the kingdom. They weren't to go to the Gentiles just to preach to Israel. They went out, they came back excited, talking about the success they had had, the demons they had cast out, what they had done to the devil while they're out on their preaching assignment. And it was right after they returned. In fact, Mark alludes to it here in Mark 6:30. Then the disciples gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. We call that the limited commission. But verse 31, he said to them, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while." And then Mark adds this statement, "For there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat." Up until this point, Christ had been ministering to the masses. But from this time on, he is wanting to get his disciples aside privately and spend time with them. And so he says, we need to get away for a while. So you come aside with me. And if we kept reading, it was right after Christ said, let's get away, that the incident involving the 5,000. Christ and the disciples sail up to the north side of the Sea of Galilee. The crowds from Capernaum and those towns see him, follow around the lake, and they're waiting when Christ in the boat and the disciples in the boat land. They didn't get any privacy. And so turn the page to Mark chapter 7. Look at verse 24. Christ can't get any privacy in Galilee with the disciples. So in verse 24, he leads the disciples out of Galilee to Gentile country. From there he arose and went to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and wanted no one to know it, but he could not be hid. Christ is trying to slip in incognito with the disciples up there, Tyre and Sidon, Gentile country. Didn't want anyone to know it, but you can't hide a city set on a hill. I mean, when you're doing the kinds of things Christ is doing, people are going to find you. And there was a lady in a desperate situation with a demonized daughter, and she found him. He could not be hid. So no privacy in Galilee, no privacy up there, Tyre and Sidon. So what does Christ do? Well, let's keep reading. Come down to chapter 8. Look at verse 26. Christ and the disciples go back into Galilee. They go on the north side of the Sea of Galilee, around to the east side, that area known as Decapolis. And Christ is taking them now back north, and they enter into Julius Beseda, not the Beseda on the northern, northwestern side of the sea, another Beseda on the eastern, northeastern side of the lake. And a blind man comes out. They brought a blind man to him, begged him that he would touch the blind man. And Christ does so. And look at verse 26, what Christ says to this man. He sent him away to his house saying, neither go into the town nor tell anyone in the town. Don't go straight back home, and certainly don't tell anybody in town. Christ is still trying to get some private time with the disciples. And finally, to find that private time, Jesus had to go to the last place any self-respecting member of the Church of Christ would go to, and that's Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi was a witch's cauldron of paganism, Judaism, and Caesar worship. And up there in the last place you'd expect to find a Christian, Christ found some privacy. Turn to Matthew 16. The reason Christ wanted to get the disciples apart was to ask them a question. And in Matthew 16, verses 13 and following, when Jesus came into the regions of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? So they said, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. If anybody said those things about us, that'd have been one of the greatest compliments we'd ever gotten. But folks, verse 14 constitutes a failure with the masses. They thought Christ was some great prophet. They thought he was something special, extraordinary. But verse 14 is a confession of failure. After all he's done, all they can do is lump him with Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets, John the Baptist. And so Christ asked in verse 15, who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter, bless his heart, answers in the most definitive, perfect answer that could have been given the question. In the Greek, what Peter says is, you are the Christ, the Son of the living, the God. No ambiguity, no gray area. It's all black or white. You are the Son of God. And Christ, I know a big smile broke out on his face. He said, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah. Do you know this is the only time Christ pronounced a specific blessing on anybody in the Gospels? Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah. You get it. You've added two and two together. Flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you, but my Father, which is in heaven. How had God revealed it to Peter? Same way God had been revealing it to everybody, by what Christ was saying, by what he was doing, by the way he was loving. And Peter got it. I read a story about Christ going back to heaven. And an angel asked him, well, what now? Christ said, well, I've left 12 men behind to carry on my work. The angel says, well, what if they fail? Christ says, I have no other plan. If these 12 didn't get it, his entire work was in jeopardy. But they got it. But even then, folks, Christ never revealed truth beyond the capacity of the audience to receive it. And if anybody was capable of hearing what Christ was going to say now, it was these 12 men who were utterly convinced of his deity. But look what Christ says in verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. And Peter said, not over my dead body. Christ said, get thee behind me, Satan. As much as they understood about the deity of Christ, they still badly missed the importance of the most important thing, and that was his death. And so Christ says some things. And then 6 days later, let's start reading in chapter 17, verse 2. 6 days later, he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun. His clothes became as white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. While he was yet speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. The transfiguration is what follows. There are two sets of participants on top of that mountain. There is Jesus, and there are the three disciples. I don't count Moses and Elijah. The transfiguration did not happen for their benefit. I believe the transfiguration happened for the sake of Christ and for the sake of the disciples. Let's talk about what it did for Christ first. Luke 9, 29 says, as he was praying, the shadow of the cross is starting to fall on Jesus. He's just talked about it explicitly for the first time. My guess is he was praying about what was coming. And what we usually pray about is that the Lord will remove whatever burdens we're having to bear. Now, Christ would ask that in the garden, wouldn't he? Let this cup pass. Let this hour pass. We ask the Lord to take away our burdens. Paul said, take away the thorn in the flesh. We ask the Lord to take away our burdens, but God may know we need the burdens. God may know the burden is what is necessary. And so what does God give us when we must bear the burden? He gives us grace sufficient for the task. 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and 10. If it's the Lord's will that we bear the burden, he gives us the wherewithal to bear it. And I think that's what happens for Christ on top of the Mount of Transfiguration. I believe grace was being given him to strengthen him, to prepare him for what lay ahead. And it came in three ways. Number one, he was transfigured. Now, don't make too much out of that word transfigured. It's the Greek word metamorphosis that we use to talk about worms, caterpillars wrapping a cocoon around them and coming out a butterfly. A change of form is what it means. But the same words used in 2 Corinthians 11 describe the devil. Three times, verses 13, 14, 15, the word metamorphosis is used of the devil, transfiguring, transforming himself into an angel of light. So don't make a whole lot out of the word per se. Make a whole lot, though, out of what happened. Now, I don't know what happened. Some say that it was Christ's inner essence, his deity, that shone forth through his humanity, but the word transfigure in the Greek refers to the outward form, not the inner essence. All I'll say about it is that when Peter commented on it, he said that Christ appeared in glory. 2 Peter 1:17, he received honor and glory. Christ was in glory. Whatever that means, that's how Peter described it. And Moses and Elijah were there. Now, commentators will tell you that they represented the law and the prophets. I don't know where the Bible ever says that. Maybe they did. I've not yet found that connection in the Bible. I'll tell you one thing about Moses and Elijah. They had unusual deaths. Moses didn't have a graveside ceremony. He didn't have a visitation. Elijah didn't even have a grave. I mean, these two men had survived death, and here they are standing. I mean, that's what Peter's objecting to. Lord, if you die, what's going to happen? They killed Thaddeus. You know what happened to his followers? That was it. They killed Judas. That was it. You cut off the head, the body dies. And then here, Moses and Elijah, long gone. And they're standing there in glory with Christ. But I think the most significant thing about Moses and Elijah is what they were talking with Jesus about. Luke 9:31 says they were talking about the English word is decease. The Greek word is exodus. They were talking about his exodus. And you know about the exodus. That was the preeminent Jewish word signifying freedom, signifying emancipation, deliverance, redemption, victory. The Lord's Supper is not the remembrance of a defeat or a loss. They were talking about what Christ would accomplish. Christ wasn't just going to endure the cross. He was going to accomplish something there. He was going to achieve something by his death. And then came the voice out of the cloud, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." Now there's one passage you really need to connect with that statement, and that's Hebrews chapter 1, the first three verses. In the wilderness, Christ said, "I'm going to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." And what does God do on the Mount of Transfiguration? He throws it back to Christ. "Hear ye him." God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in times past to the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken to us by his Son. Hear him. Because when you hear Christ, you're hearing God. And if you look hard at Hebrews 1:1-3, you'll see the three offices of Christ stressed there: prophet, priest, and king. He's the prophet by whom God speaks. He's the king, the son, who's going to be the heir of all things. And he's the priest who's going to wash us from our sins. And from the cloud, "This is my beloved son," king, because he's the heir, "in whom I'm well pleased," priest. The priest had to be acceptable to God in order to approach God. "Hear him," prophet. Because of the change that came over him, the visitors he had, the topic they discussed, the voice from heaven, I believe that all encouraged Christ, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross and accomplished something in the enduring. What about the disciples? Well, Luke tells us that the disciples did on the Mount of Transfiguration the same thing they would do in the Garden of Gethsemane. They slept. While Christ prayed, they slept. And when they awake, they see Moses. I don't know how they knew who Moses and Elijah were. Maybe they had those sticky things, you know, when you go to a convention. I don't know how they knew. But Peter says something. He says, "Lord, it's good for us to be here. Let's make three tabernacles, one for you, Moses and Elijah. And in Mark's gospel, and this may have been Peter's biographical admission of how stupid what he just said was, Mark tells us that he said that not knowing what he said. And I'm going to tell you something. If I'd been there, I couldn't have done any better than Peter did. If I said anything, I'm sure it would have been as stupid as what Peter suggested. But I mean, Peter's thinking, now this is what I'm talking about. Week before, be it far from thee, Lord, this will never happen to thee. Now he wakes up, glory, Moses. Now, this is what I've got in mind. And then the glory passed. Peter would come to see things differently, wouldn't he? In his first epistle, what's his theme? Suffering and glory. He would come to see things differently. But during the dark days that were soon to come, the days of the arrests, the days of the kangaroo court, the days of the scourging, the days of the hanging, the Sabbath, when he was gone, I hope they remembered his glory. I hope they remembered what they had seen. I hope they remembered what they heard. And folks, in days of doubt and difficulty, let us hold to those things most surely believed among us. Let the fact that we're headed for glory, Romans 2:7, Romans 2:10, that we're headed for glory, get us through whatever we must get through. In Luke 9:51, if we'd been following this story in Luke's account, we'd get down to verse 51 and we would read that Christ steadfastly set his face for Jerusalem. He's going to go through with it. After the transfiguration, no turning back, he is going to Jerusalem. And I believe the transfiguration encouraged the Lord in all of that. It's good for us to be here. Listen, it's good for us to be on the Mount of Glory. It's good for us to be in the valley of the shadow of death, if that's where God is and that's where he wants us to be. And let's all try to show the kind of courage and faith and confidence in God that our Lord did. Thank you so much for listening tonight.